Run the neck?
Yeah. Oops.
So, we're pleased to have Mike Henderson be the discussion.
Thank you. So the topic of what I'd like to talk about and have a discussion about is this question of whether anti-de Sitter space-time is stable in a dynamical sense or not. So maybe let me spend a bit of time, first of all, sort of introducing the setting for this question in a broader context, and then later on we'll focus on the question of anti-de Sitter space per se itself first. I'm not sure how much we can assume about the audience, how much that knows about relativity or things like this.
You have a mixed math physics audience.
All right. So maybe in the beginning anyway, well, I'll be rather basic. Is that okay? Or?
Sure.
When you're looking at solutions to the Einstein equations and relativity, let's first of all start off with Minkowski space. So here, this is just flat R4, and the metric is just the Minkowski metric, so it looks just like here this is written down in coordinates. So this is the standard flat solution, flat space-time solution of the Einstein equations. So this satisfies the equations. The Ricci curvature is zero. So what does it mean? What does stability mean in this context? As far as I understand it, in physics you sort of two notions of stability, which to mathematicians are vastly different things. On the one hand, there's the positive mass theorem that many of you are familiar with, which says that, for instance, take the following. Here's R3, so a complete space-like hypersurface in Minkowski space, and take some perturbation of this initial data set. So Minkowski's, the Einstein equations are a hyperbolic set of equations, and you solve them by solving an initial value problem. So you specify initial data on some initial hypersurface. So for this flat solution here, here's your space. You start off with a metric on that space. This will be the Euclidean metric. The Einstein equations are second order equations. So the Cauchy problem involves the function itself at the boundary as well as its velocity at the boundary. So you need a time derivative of this quantity also at the boundary. So you move the metric in a time direction, the normal direction somewhat, that's a velocity, and invariantly that's the second fundamental form. So you prescribe a second fundamental form for the Minkowski metric is just zero. So the Cauchy, if you take this as your Cauchy data, if you take this as your initial data set on this space, this is the flat metric, zero second fundamental form, the Cauchy problem for the Einstein equations is well posed. You can start off with this data and generate a unique, well-defined solution to the future and to the past. So that's how you generate Minkowski space from this initial data here. Suppose now you take some other initial data set, which is not this one, but some other one. Let's say could be a small perturbation or maybe a large perturbation. Just some initial data set which has an initial, say topologically, for example, it's R3, it has some metric on it, and it has some second fundamental form. There's some constraints that these might satisfy, but let's not worry about those for the moment. So you have some initial data set, and you assume that it's asymptotically flat, so the metric tends to the Euclidean metric at a relatively fast rate, second fundamental form tends to zero at a relatively fast rate. You can then define a mass, and the positive mass conjecture is that this mass that you can construct from the asymptotic behavior of this solution is positive. And the mass is meant to incorporate the total mass encompassed by this initial data set as a whole. So this was an important issue in general relativity, but that's one issue, one notion of stability in a certain sense. But that issue only has to do with the structure of a single initial data set. So you start off with some initial data set for the Einstein equations and ask the positivity of the mass of that initial data set. So it's a fixed slice in time. So you're looking at Riemannian geometry on a three manifold in some sense. That has nothing to do, as far as I know, regarding the dynamical stability of the solution generated by this initial data set. So you could take an initial data set like this and look at the evolution that's generated from that initial data to the future and to the past.
Is this mass well-defined if you took a different initial data set for the same solution?
Yeah. As long as to a certain extent, yeah. If you take let's see. You have to worry about the asymptotic behavior. Certainly, if you take compact perturbations of a given thing, you're fine. The trouble is, though, that the mass will change as you evolve this thing to the future. The mass will decrease, typically. So if you look at this and evolve it forward to a future time, the mass will decrease. So it's not an invariant of the initial data set in the space-time itself as a whole.
It only decreases if you consider asymptotically null surfaces. Any asymptotically flat surface, you do the same
method. Okay. That's why I'm confused.
That's asymptotically flat
Initial data. All right. So you only see the radiation going off to off to null infinity.
Okay.
Thank you. All right. So suppose you take there's a famous theorem that if you take a not a large perturbation but a small perturbation of this flat Minkowski data, so say this is now close, say these two data here are close, then there's a theorem of Christodoulou-Kleinermann. So this is called this is the global stability of Minkowski space that. An initial data set which is sufficiently close to the flat initial data set and which decays to the flat initial data set at affinity sufficiently fast, that generates a solution of the Einstein equations which is globally complete. So it's complete to the future for all time, and it's complete also to the past for all time. And as you go forward in time, as you evolve to the future in time, your geometry is becoming flatter and flatter and flatter. So if you view this as a dynamical system, so you think of the Einstein flow as like a flow on the phase space. So you have your configuration space is the space of Riemannian metrics on a fixed three manifold. So here you have fixed topology in dimension three. So in this case, say R3. You look at metrics on R3. That's the configuration space. The phase space for that the second manifold is like momenta. And so the Einstein equations are like a flow on this phase space, and this theorem says that the flow lines of perturbations of the standard solution limit to the future to the future plus infinity and to the past minus infinity to the original solution you started off with. So this is dynamically stable. As far as I know, and if we have discussions about this, maybe the physicists have some different perspective or more knowledge. I don't really understand much relation between these two phenomena of positive mass and dynamical stability. Mathematically, this positive mass is just you're looking at the structure of a fixed initial data set at some given time, and the evolution as a dynamical system plays no role. Whereas the second part here is purely asymptotic behavior of the dynamical systems, of the dynamical system you're looking at.
Well, the mass is not only for the initial data, right?
Yeah.
You can take a later space-like hypersurface that will give you also the mass.
Yeah, well, as Gary just pointed out,
the
really mass is the same.
It's really quantity for the space-time. So in a way, the mass is... it's a function defined for all.
But for instance, I could imagine the positive mass theorem failing, whereas this theorem here being true, or vice versa, the positive mass theorem being true, but this theorem here failing. I don't see why should they be Yeah.
I mean, I basically agree with you. I think they're very different notions of stability. Physicists do tend to, you know, use them interchangeably because we have this idea. I mean, the positive mass theorem says not only is the mass always positive or really non-negative, but it's zero if and only if it's in Minkowski space.
Yeah.
So the idea is that if you start, you know, at Minkowski space, you will stay there. If you start very close to Minkowski space, the intuition is you're not going to run off far away because that would somehow cost a lot of energy and you can't get negative energy from anywhere. But, you know, Einstein's equations could have been such that a little bit of excess energy would collapse to black holes.
Right, right.
And it's a dynamical question that doesn't happen.
Right.
And if it had happened, then the second notion of stability wouldn't happen.
Right.
I guess the mass notion of stability is kind of more primitive. It's like a potential, and the Minkowski space sits at the bottom potential. So if you are nearby, you would be forced to go back to the bottom of the potential well. But then that would indicate dynamic stability should be true too, if the mass theorem is true. But of course, it doesn't give you proof.
Yeah, yeah. Were you going to suggest something, Tom?
I was just going to, I believe, if I remember correctly, that this is somehow inherently basic to the proof. In order to control the energy, you do need this positivity because you know, sort of all the estimates are based on energy calculations. And if that's not positive, then you're really lost at the beginning.
So in the proof of the crystal of Kynman theorem, they're implicitly using the positive mass theorem?
I mean, maybe it is true in that case, but I was talking to De Fermos, this mathematician at Cambridge.
Yeah.
He said that he could prove some generalization of crystalline Kynman to include a scalar field.
Uh-huh.
And again, showing that you have this global existence for small data. But he then noticed that it didn't depend on the sign of the sort of energy of the scalar field. So he could actually couple scalar field with negative energy to gravity and still show that
global solutions.
So again, it was more this dispersive nature of the field.
Right.
The waves want to go out and not collapse.
Right. Right.
Christopher Dolo and the Kynman theorem, they only deal with the small perturbation of the Minkowski data. So I imagine how the method won't play a very crucial role there.
Well, yeah. I mean, if I'm right, the structure of the null, the behavior of the null cones, is influenced by the mass near infinity, and that is somehow is a delicate issue they have to deal with somehow, if I vaguely remember.
Yeah, the improvement goes by constructing good foliation of the space time.
Yeah, yeah.
And then look at the equation along those leaves.
Yeah.
So that doesn't seem to use the mass very much.
All right. So this is the rough picture of Minkowski space, and so one has these two fantastic theorems, which do tell you a lot: the positive mass theorem on the one hand, and the stability theorem of Minkowski space on the other hand. You could look at other kinds of standard solutions of the Einstein equations. So this is, in terms of Riemannian geometry, this is the analog of flat Euclidean space. In Riemannian geometry, people study as well spaces of positive curvature and negative curvature, so spherical spaces and hyperbolic spaces. So let's just look briefly at analogous issues in that context. So the positive case, this is De Sitter. So here you can write down, this corresponds to lambda positive. This is like positive scalar curvature. And so it's a space of constant, in some sense, it's a space of constant positive sectional curvature. It's a solution of the Einstein equations. So here's, let me write down the metric here as well. Minus dt squared. Saved. So we do things, let's go to any dimension now. Maybe I should have said that, so one is interested not only in four dimensions but in higher dimensions. So there's the issue of positive mass in higher dimensions. There, since this original work of Christodoul Kleinermann in the late 80s, early 90s, there have been newer proofs of their result. The most recent proof by Lindblad Rodnianski. So this is in the past few years. At least both of them tell me that their proof holds in all dimensions. In fact, it's easier in higher dimensions. That it's hardest to prove this in four dimensions, and the higher the dimension, the easier it gets to prove. So this is okay in all dimensions. So here's the de Sitter space-time in all dimensions. Notice that if you sort of did a weak rotation to this, if you made time pure imaginary, this would turn into a plus sign, this cosh would turn into a cosine, and this would just be an n plus one dimensional sphere in polar coordinates. So there's a nice correspondence going back and forth like that. So if you draw a picture of this, it looks sort of like this. So at time zero, this is smallest at time zero, so you have a sphere of radius one at time zero, that's the spatial universe, and then as time evolves to the future, this space is expanding exponentially fast. And the same mirror behavior to the past like this. So here you can't talk about mass so well because this metric is not static. To define mass, you usually need something like a asymptotic killing field, time-like killing field. You don't have that in this setting. You don't also have any asymptotic spatial infinity. Here, space is compact, where here it's non-compact and complete. But you can ask for a dynamical stability. So here's your Cauchy data. So at time zero, say you take the n-dimensional sphere, take the metric of curvature plus one on it, and take, I guess again, k equals zero. Is that right? Yeah. Zero second final form at time zero. So this solution this Cauchy data generates a solution to the Einstein equations. The Ricci curvature, in this case, is equal to ng in n plus one dimensions. So this is again a hyperbolic set of evolution equations. Here's your Cauchy data, your initial data for it. Use that to evolve to the future and to the past. This data here generates this global solution to smooths to the future and to the past. So now take a perturbation of this. So S, N, G, and K, where G is close to the round metric and K is close to zero, and ask what happens in that case. So here things are also now well understood. This was in 3 plus 1 dimensions. There's a theorem of Helmut Friedrich. That you do have global stability. A small perturbation generates a global solution to the future and to the past. And in fact, you can compactify things smoothly. You have a smooth future infinity, future space-like infinity, and a smooth past-like infinity. A few years ago, in even dimensions, so n plus one even. So I did myself in even dimensions using a similar conformal compactification that Friedrich used. So Friedrich converted the Einstein equations into a conformally invariant system of equations, somewhat more complicated system of equations which had conformal invariance properties. So I found some different set of equations that worked in all even dimensions, but the principle is the same. More recently, this was in 2004, just last year, Hans Ringström proved stability of de Sitter space in all dimensions. This was by a straight PDE proof, straight PDE methods. Just analyzing the way analyzing the wave equations that these Einstein equations become in a certain gauge. And the stability here is this: all these theorems are much, much easier than these theorems here.
I'm just curious, do these questions have analog for definite metrics as well? I mean, starting off with initial data and asking for Einstein metrics.
What do you mean by definite? Positive?
It would have no negative signs in the metric.
But then you can't prescribe a Cauchy problem then. So then the Einstein equations are elliptic, and the Cauchy problem for elliptic equations is not well defined. It's not a well posed problem to look at both prescribe. You have some initial manifold, and you want to thicken that up to m cross I, and you want to solve the Einstein equation on a thickening given initial data on some slice m. You can't. It's not well posed. There's no hope you can do that, just because the character of the equation is elliptic versus hyperbolic.
So you're saying only in very special cases, like an equator, codimension one equator on a sphere.
So it's just like for the Laplacian. Look at the equation Laplacian u equals zero. So this is like an analog of a toy model of a Ricci flat metric on a domain. You can solve the Laplace equation, but you can solve it with a given boundary values. So u restricted to the boundary is f. You can solve that equation globally if you give f globally on the boundary. But the Cauchy data, so this is like the metric. But the Cauchy data would involve the normal derivative of that.
You can't specify both the function and derivative.
Independently. So of course there are solutions. So from those solutions you can get some pairs which will be satisfied. But you can't specify in advance independently what u is and what the metric is and k is, or u and its normal derivative.
But suppose you just didn't try to over-specify the equation. I mean, is it still an interesting geometric question to just give the geometry on a hypersurface and ask whether it extends in one more dimension to a Einstein metric?
Yeah, it is, I think, yeah. But I don't know of any ways of attacking that except indirectly by, say, solving some global Dirichlet problem and then looking at this Dirichlet and Neumann kind of map. That would be the standard way one would approach such a thing. I don't know of any other ways besides that.
Okay, so basically there is no natural analog to this question.
Not that I know of, or not that I've seen or know of or can think of. Yeah, because of this So the Einstein equations in relativity with this Lorentzian signature, they're really evolutionary. But in the Riemannian context, they're not.
Can you say a word about why that is, why it leads to a hyperbolic equation instead of an elliptic equation?
So you just look at the Laplacian. It's Gij partial I partial j. So for any pseudo Riemannian manifold in suitable coordinates, the Laplacian is just this.
Yeah, okay,
and so you got one minus sign here and three pluses, so it's a wave equation.
Yeah.
You kind of say the corresponding correct version is the Ricci flow equation. So you also
Well, that's sort of in between. That's parabolic, right? It's sort of
if you want just to specify the initial metric, then you want to go forward.
That's true, yeah. Yeah,
yeah, that's
true. Yeah. Okay, thank you for that remedial point.
Yes. okay, so this situation here is quite satisfactory as far as stability goes. And again, this is much, much easier to prove than the flat case. So then that leads in then to the third possibility, which is physicists call anti-de Sitter space. So here the cosmological constant is negative, or the scalar curvature is negative. So here we're looking again at solutions to the Einstein equations, which now have a negative cosmological constant, again minus n, say. There's some relation between lambda and n here, so up to a scale. So what's the formula for anti de Sitter metric? So in n plus one dimensions, this is what it looks like. Again, you can easily convert by making t here imaginary. Just change t to it. This is a form for the hyperbolic metric in Riemannian geometry. So you just think of this part here. This looks like a hyperbolic metric. This is in fact a hyperbolic metric of constant curvature minus one in polar coordinates. So this is the n-dimensional ball. So this is the complete hyperbolic metric on the n-dimensional ball. And now you're just evolving that in time to the future and to the past with this factor in front of it, radial factor in front of it. Cosh squared of r, yeah. So the picture you could draw of this is you start off with a hyperbolic metric, Bn, with g minus 1. K is 0 here. And evolve that to the future. And to the past. Let's see. I mean, this is the standard picture one draws. Let me just... So a lot of you are familiar with this formulation of the hyperbolic metric in the Poincaré model. Let this parameterize a complete geodesic. Let's say this geodesic here. So here you are at Hn plus 1. And you let this t here be a parameter for this geodesic, and then the orthogonal space to that is this hyperbolic n space here, and in these so you have this foliation of hyperbolic n space. You take this totally geodesic hypersurface, hyperbolic space, and translate it to the future or to the past. It looks like this, right? And you have corresponding the equidistance to this geodesic transverse to that. So this decomposition of hyperbolic space into these leaves is the same thing as what you're doing here. So this serves as the time direction. So these are the spatial slices. All right. So this metric satisfies this equation here. You'd like to say that this is a Cauchy surface, and in some sense it sort of is. So here's your topological manifold. Here's your initial data, your initial metric, and your initial velocity. Notice there's no t's here. So there's no in these coefficient functions, there's no t's. This is a time-independent solution. There's no in these coordinates, it's time-independent. Just like this solution is time-independent. It's called static. So the anti-de-Sitter metric is static. It's independent of time. Translation and t is an isometry. The geometry doesn't change as you move forward or backwards in time. The trouble is that... The basic question is whether this solution is stable or not, in the same sense as before. So So take some perturbation of this data here and ask whether you have a global existence to the future and to the past. The difficulty is that this problem here is a very different character from these two. All three of these are quite different in character. This is by far the easiest. This is now solved. I don't know of any results on this at all. Not even partial results or anything really significant about the stability for this. The problem is that this is, in some sense, this is not a well-posed Cauchy problem. If you look at the future domain of dependence of this initial of this Cauchy surface here, so you take this initial data set. This is complete. It's a complete hyperbolic metric. So this is a very schematic picture. So this boundary here is at infinity, of course, right? It's like here is the boundary of the hyperbolic ball. So this is the sphere at infinity in hyperbolic space, and this is the corresponding time evolution of that boundary. Just like here's the Riemannian hyperbolic ball. So this boundary here is at infinity. This is the sphere at infinity. As mathematicians well know, and hyperbolic geometers well know, there's a strong correspondence between the hyperbolic geometry of the interior and the conformal geometry at the boundary. You can conformally compactify the hyperbolic metric, so it just becomes the Euclidean metric. Same thing here. You can conformally compactify this metric so that instead of things living at infinity, you can imagine them they make a conformal change. Infinity now lives at finite distance, and then you get this more accurate finite, well, easier to draw a finite version of this metric. It's G tilde ADS. The boundary here is now just a product. So if you want to make infinity finite, all you have to do here is just divide by, say, cosh squared of r. So just multiply this whole metric by 1 over cosh squared r. That cancels this. You just have a dt squared here. So that's just a straight line in the time direction. At the boundary, the boundary is where r is going to infinity. So this the r here is a radial distance. And so this boundary here is where r goes to infinity. So at infinity, this is no longer, you just drop this. This is being dropped. R is like the distance from the center out to the boundary, or the distance from infinity back in. And so you only have this piece and this piece. This is dropped, divided by cosh. Well, cosh is the same as sinh at infinity, so this drops out. So you just have here I cross, you just have dt squared plus gsm minus 1. This is called the Einstein cylinder. So the conformal boundary of the anti de Sitter metric is this Einstein cylinder, and that's an analog of the conformal compactification of hyperbolic space, the sphere. So going back to why this is not a well posed problem. It turns out the domain of because of this conformal picture like this, if you look at light rays, let's go over this picture here. So this is the conformally compactified setting. This is the complete uncompact setting. Light rays are invariant under conformal change of the metric. These are the null geodesics don't depend upon the conformal properties of the metric. They're conformally invariant, and so that this is a compact picture. This is a finite picture. And look at the properties of light rays. There, you take a light ray here, and you'll get this cone here. the so-called domain of dependence of this Cauchy surface is this finite region here. That's very different than over here. Here, if you go far out and look at light rays, go far out here and look at light rays, you cover a very large piece of Minkowski space. The further out you go, the larger portion you get. And if you go all the way out to infinity, you cover the whole Minkowski space. That's not happening here. This initial slice only covers this little piece here of the space-time. So, in other words, there are light rays which in the interior can hit the boundary, or vice versa, can come from the boundary into the interior without touching this initial Cauchy surface. That means that the solution is not, you cannot generate a unique solution by from this data here. You need more information than the Cauchy data to generate a unique solution. So this is now an initial boundary value problem. Whereas before, it was just initial value. Before, you just had initial value problem to solve. So the Cauchy problem was well posed here. All you had to do is had initial data and look at the evolution of that initial data. Now, the initial data you have here only determines the space-time uniquely in this region here. It doesn't tell you at all the behavior of the space-time outside this diamond. And so you have to specify data here on the boundary to get a unique solution to the equations. So what boundary data should you choose? Well, there's various choices here, but the natural one. So here's the simplest, here's the more precise formulation of the question, stability. So here's the question. So let's let Bn, G, K be a small perturbation of pure ADS initial data, so that's the Cauchy data we want to impose, and then for the boundary data, we'll just fix the boundary data to be the pure ADS boundary data, namely the Einstein cylinder. The small perturbation of pure ADS initial data with boundary data. Boundary data equal to the Einstein cylinder. Okay, so this picture here, you take a small perturbation of Cauchy data on this disk here, and at infinity you prescribe the metric. You prescribe the metric to be this product metric, this Einstein cylinder here, and ask whether the corresponding solution to the Einstein equations exists globally to the past and the future. So does this generate a global solution? Global in the sense that G is a complete solution to the future and the past. And you could ask, is it asymptotic to the original ADS space? So this is the question, and I've explained here why it's mathematically somewhat hard. And there are very few results. You should think of this. You should think of just the linear analog of this. Just the toy model of this would just be the wave equation. And so now you're solving the wave equation now on a cylinder. So you've got for example a disk of finite radius, and solve a wave equation on a disk on a ball of finite radius, and impose fixed Dirichlet boundary data on the boundary of that ball. For the wave equation, you will have global. You have the prescribe some initial data for the wave equation, and prescribe the boundary data, say Dirichlet data on the boundary, just zero boundary values. That's the analog of this. This is like Dirichlet data. For a linear wave equation, you will have global existence to the future and the past. So this is, there's some interesting work carried out by Wald and Ishibashi. So they analyze the linear stability of this problem. So this is a nonlinear problem. If you want to look at the Einstein equations, but you can just look at a much simpler linear problem where you linearize things at the pure ADS solution. So just look at linearized perturbations, linearized solutions to the Einstein equations. This forms a system of wave equations so you look at linearized solutions to the Einstein equations in, say, L2 of the Cauchy surface. In physics, in this ADS CFT business, physicists call these things the so-called normalized modes. These form the sort of what physicists are not so involved much in the class. This is a very classical question. This ADS CFT correspondence, much more is going on in the quantum level of things than on the classical level of things, although mathematicians are very much interested in a lot of the classical issues in ADS CFT. But this is an infinite dimensional space of solutions, so it's a Hilbert space. And it's one of the things you first look at when you start to quantize things. So you have a lot of linear perturbations. So that's not surprising. You'd expect you have there should be lots of solutions to these Einstein equations in this context. So this is what you'd expect. What they show, and this is not particularly difficult, it's just a matter of just writing down the equations and choosing appropriate coordinates, looking at spherical harmonic expansion and so forth. It's kind of laborious, but it was important to do it, I think. So they proved that these linearized solutions they of course exist, they are global. Are global and oscillatory. There's no decay. There's no decay or dispersion, like there is in the case of no decay or dispersion. Everything is sort of periodic. It's like it's just like a wave in a finite box here. Where you pin down the edges, so the you have these, as you would do in Fourier series, you would do a Fourier decomposition, so you have the fundamental modes, and those oscillate, and those oscillations persist for all time. They're not damped or anything. The wave just continues oscillating at the same frequency, at the same amplitude for all time to the future. And a general solution is just a superposition of that. So the same kind of phenomenon holds in this context. Again, this is a time-independent solution. ADS itself is static.
It means oscillatory in space direction? But if it's oscillatory in space direction, no decay, then how can that be like a perturbation of the anti-dissipatory?
Well, what do you why couldn't it be?
Well, in order
so it's not, it's
for it to be perturbation, small perturbation,
yeah.
You need a decay at infinity.
That's sort of the problem. If you take a small initial perturbation, that perturbation doesn't die down or damp off. It just persists. It stays the same size for all time to the future and the past.
I think the point is that these modes are all in L2. So they do decay.
They do decay because he says there's no decay. So I'm a little confused about that.
Oh, I'm talking about decay. I meant decay in time, to the future, to the future in time.
They don't decay in time.
Okay. Right.
First, at infinity. Okay.
Right. Right. So they sort of bounce. Right. I mean, so they're in L2, so they sort of look like this. But as this thing goes forward, these things sort of slosh back and forth against these walls here, right? As this thing moves, this thing goes back and forth and sloshes, bounces back and forth on the boundary. So this is a fundamental problem this is not surprising in some sense. Going back to what Gary said before, in the flat case, in the Christodoulou-Kleinermann case, although the mass is preserved on these Cauchy surfaces, which are asymptotically flat, nevertheless, as you go forward in time, radiation sort of does escape, and so the mass in any sort of finite region is decreasing, although, and so in the limiting behavior at future infinity, you have no mass at all. The mass has all disappeared at time infinity. So in the limit, you have the flat solution. Here you don't have that. Here the mass is preserved on these Cauchy surfaces here. So the mass is staying the same for all time. It's even asymptotically is staying the same. You're not losing mass even at time like infinity, to the future or to the past. So there's not even any decay of mass. Let me just throw in the following. For those of you who were here yesterday, to see my talk yesterday, we talked about this isometry extension theorem. It was talked about in the context of Einstein metrics on bounded domains, but it's also true in the Riemannian context for complete metrics. So let me just mention the following result, which is very similar to what was talked about yesterday. So here's a theorem. Suppose that MG, this is complete Riemannian. So now this is the big difference between the Lorentzian situation we're discussing here. Complete Riemannian Einstein, and it's conformally compact. So just like this Andrew de Sitter space is, or hyperbolic space itself is conformally compact, you can conformally compactify it. Then any killing field or conformal killing field doesn't matter. Any killing field on the boundary, so at infinity, so either in your Riemannian setting, the sphere at infinity is like the round metric on the sphere at infinity. Any killing field on the boundary extends to a killing field in the bulk. And MG, and this is any Einstein metric, any G and M. So no matter what the interior manifold is, no matter what the Einstein metric is, for any such, as long as it's Einstein, the killing field on the boundary extends to a killing field in the interior, in the bulk. What does that mean in this context? So imagine this. So this is the Riemannian setting. Just imagine this was true in the Lorentzian setting. What would it say? Well, it would say that here's this conformal compactification of ADS. The conformal boundary is this Einstein cylinder. You have lots and lots of killing fields here. For instance, just take this one here. Take the time translation. So it would say that the time translation killing field on the boundary would extend to a time translation isometry in the interior, no matter what solution that you had. Right, so take some solution, take some perturbation of pure ADS. So take some Cauchy surface, which is a perturbation of the pure ADS Cauchy surface, and pin down the Dirichlet boundary data here. Imagine you have a look at the solution that generates to the future and to the past. So imagine you've got a complete solution that way. Just suppose we did. Then if take the Lorentzian analog of this, if it held, what would it say? It would say that the time-like killing field here on the boundary, which we have because the boundary is being fixed, extends to a time-like killing field in the interior. So that means that the interior solution is stationary. So it's time-independent, just like ADS is time-independent. In fact, all this space here has lots of symmetries. All the symmetries of this solution would extend to give you symmetries of any solution in the interior, any solution in the bulk. Well, the only solution, the Einstein equation, which has so much symmetries as this, is pure ADS. So in other words, if this theorem were true to a Lorentzian setting, that would say that there aren't any global perturbations of Minkowski's of any De Sitter space. There just aren't any at all. This solution is unique in a global sense. That's unknown. That might be true. But it might not be true. It's just who knows. So there may not be any global perturbations of this space. Of course, you can take a perturbation of Cauchy data, and you can find a solution for some period of time to the future and the past. But nothing will guarantee. There's no theorem that guarantee that solution exists for all time to the future and all time to the past. So nothing is known about a global solution. Something like this would rule out the existence of a non-trivial global solution, and if that held, it would say that ADS is unstable. So this theorem in the Lorentzian setting would imply that ADS is unstable because you couldn't have any global evolutions to the future or and past. Something would have to go wrong in finite time. There'd have to be some kind of singularity or something happening in finite time. Pardon?
So your theorem indicates there can't be any...
No, I don't know. I just don't know. So the proof of this theorem in the Riemannian case does not go through in the Lorentzian case. In fact, there's a semi-counterexample. So it's not. This may be true in the Lorentzian setting. It may not be true. I just don't know. The proof doesn't go through. Some version of this is false in the Lorentzian setting, though. Here's an example. I can't say this too well, but here's the anti-De Sitter metric. Some of you may have heard about anti-De Sitter Schwarzschild metrics or anti-De Sitter Kerr metrics. It turns out that the anti-De Sitter Schwarzschild metric has the same boundary as this. And also the Kerr, the ADS Kerr metric, also has the same boundary as this. But the Kerr metric, although the Schwarzschild metric inherits the isometries of this, the Kerr metric does not inherit all the isometries of this. So the ADS Kerr metric has this as its conformal boundary, but the symmetries of the conformal boundary are not inherited into the bulk of ADS Kerr. That's not so surprising from this point of view because Kerr has singularities in it. So the conformal infinity doesn't really look like this. It's I can't for Kerr. It's much more complicated than this, but. The Kerr metric has an event horizon. There's a black hole in it. And this horizon hits infinity sort of in finite time. And so the singularities here propagate to give you sort of singularities of the boundary. So the boundary is not complete. So that's why this proof, the proof is false, but it also breaks down because of these singularities here hitting the boundary. But,
So you're saying it possibly starts with a small perturbation, it stops around for a while, turns into a black hole?
Yeah.
This seems not impossible physically, too, based on, you know, the applications to
so
it's thermal in the dual gauge theory, it's thermalization.
No, it's not exactly that, because this would be a really small black hole.
Well, yeah. Small, I mean, there's no H-bar in the problem, so I'm not sure how to sort of talk about it.
I mean, I think the picture is more analogous to putting sort of some gas in a box.
Yeah.
And we believe in, you know, physics that if you wait long enough, all the gas will eventually be in some small volume, you know, in the corner of the box. Momentarily, it can sort of get there and then it sort of disperse again.
Yeah.
So a perturbation, a finite perturbation in ADS is like putting a lot of gravitons
in a
box.
Yeah.
In ADS.
Yeah.
And if you wait long enough, all those gravitons will be expected to sort of be in the same small volume. And that's what you need to form a little black hole. So I think from a sort of physics standpoint, it's not implausible that you're right, that there's no other global solution besides ADS.
Does that cause any problems for this ADS-CFT kind of business? That would say that ADS is sort of unstable, right?
Yeah.
That, in a dynamical sense, that you can't...
Classically,
yeah.
These black holes don't live very long. They quickly evaporate, and then you're back to your perturbation. So it's sort of like a small black hole that lives a very short time. And I think in the gauge theory probably hardly noticed this. the gauge theory will continue to evolve, and I don't see a problem with
ADS-CFT. I'm confused, because there's another thing about where it really, I mean, there is just a, if you had enough modes in there, they would sort of get into thermal equilibrium.
Right.
And we kind of think that thermal equilibrium in the gauge theory is a black hole in the bulk.
Right.
So maybe that's a bigger perturbation.
That's a much bigger perturbation.
Yeah. Right.
This would be for very small finite.
The other thing is if you just put a few gravitons in, if, you know, to get them all in one spot, that's not really a GR. Particularly evolution, that's some ensemble of these things.
But he has no H-bar, so even a small perturbation is kind of an arbitrary large number of gravitons.
Just some pinch points,
right.
At some point, they're going to have to work.
Yeah.
Very local.
I mean, I've spent some time last fall talking with both De Fermos and Rodnyansky about this. They have somewhat different opinions. De Fermos thinks for sure singularities will have to form. That there's no way this thing can be stable, just because these waves will tend to focus. They'll have to focus and concentrate energy in some small region at some finite time to the future. Rodnyansky is more, I think, neutral, sort of standing on the fence in this issue. He's not so convinced. It's. I mean, as a sort of pure classical hyperbolic PDE kind of issue, it's certainly really interesting, but also seems really hard. Some people might be doing some numerical work on it, I think, in the future.
Do you learn anything by thinking about spherical symmetry, or is that too special to general lessons?
You might. I mean, De Fermos is exactly the kind of guy who would do that kind of thing, I think, yeah. He's done a lot in spherical symmetry with related problems.
He'd have to add a scale, right? But he couldn't do it
pure. Right, that's right.
Yeah, yeah. That's exactly what he's done with cosmic censorship type of things, yeah. Yeah. That might be a reasonable testing ground to look at first, yeah.
May not be the generic situation. But
yeah.
Yeah, but it would be a good example. Spherically symmetric scalar, if you could show that even weak data always produces singularity.
Right, well, that would be very suggestive, yeah. Yeah.
Shown before.
Yeah, yeah.
That does sound like the sort of problem that Fermos would be able to solve.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The other question that occurs to me, given this picture, this outline picture of a black hole forming within the quantum theory going away, is could you do something like Hamilton-Perelman surgery if you got singularities forming? So might there be some meaningful sense in which there was an evolution that went through some funny topological phase and then continued to find evolution beyond that, which would represent the temporary black hole which in the quantum theory would
go away? Yeah, yeah, yeah. So this is sort of keeping things more in a more classical world in of itself, but accounting for it is
that's right.
classical behavior as a dynamical system in some sense. Yeah. Yeah, that's certainly very.
Singularity formation itself is not necessarily fatal to long-time evolution. I guess is the lesson that we.
I guess, but Perelman's sort of the first guy who's succeeded in handling this or understanding it.
Yeah. Well, I guess Hamilton did have this idea in the four-dimensional case pretty clearly. Well, you're more of an expert on
it. No, well, it's. In any case, these issues of the Ricci flow are the first. You know, this recent work, relatively recent work, is the first time this has really been successfully carried out. It would certainly be fantastic to do something analogous in relativity, sort of, for these hyperbolic equations. I mean, people haven't even. There's. I don't think mathematicians have looked that much, for instance, at the behavior of these kind of chop-tweak solutions. I think these are much. I don't know much about these. I tried to look at them once a while ago, but does anybody here know if they're actually explicit solutions, these chop-tweak solutions, or?
Let's see. So, explicit. In some cases, you can. There's always numerical.
They're numerically, numerical.
Because they. Either have discrete self-similarity or continuous self-similarity.
Yeah.
Even in the continuous case, it's a one-dimensional ODE that has to be solved numerically.
These are kind of solutions which have, in some sense, an isolated point singularity. Just at one precise event in space-time. So imagine to the past everything is smooth. So you're somebody in the past, everything is smooth, and then at some moment in time, at one particular point, you have a singularity occurring. And then to the future, in some sense, there's only a weak remnant of that singularity that propagates along the light cone of that point. So the curvature is, I think, not smooth across the light cone. It's maybe distributionally. Instead of C2, it's like L2 infinity, something like this. The jump discontinuity, I think. And then in the interior of the light cone, it's smooth again. So I don't think there's any topology change or anything like this. So there's no topology being sort of sucked into that singularity. But a surgery argument, you could sort of try to adapt on there. Trouble is the singularity does propagate all the way out in the light cone, so you can't sort of localize the whole. It's not sort of smooth outside a compact set, but you just have to think a bit hard how to do it.
Thanks.
Good. Well, thank you.
So I'm going to take right
now. Hi. So I enjoyed that.
Yeah, thanks. Oh, I enjoyed your answers too. It was helpful.
It is a very interesting question.